Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
I'm Musa Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Governor Westmore recently vetoed a study of reparations for African Americans. What does this veto signal about his commitment to the folks who elected him? Abraham Traore, president of Burkina Faso, energized African politics and became the target of President Trump. Stay tuned. Good morning. I am your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the host of What's at Stake every fourth Wednesday of the month. Our first guest is Mr. Davon Love. Mr. Love is director of public policy for the Baltimore-based think tank, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We will discuss the decision by Governor Westmore to veto Maryland's reparation bill, SB 587. I'd like to clarify that Governor Moore did not veto a reparations payout bill, but a bill that was intended simply to study reparations. So good morning, Davon.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. Many people were surprised that Governor Moore would veto a bill simply designed to study the contours of restorative justice or reparations. Were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised because, you know, I was engaged in the work to help craft the legislation, to move it through the legislature. And so during the legislative session, this past legislative session, I had been hearing things kind of second and third hand about the governor trying to kill the bill, like as we were trying to move it. So I wasn't surprised when he vetoed the bill. I was disappointed at what I was hearing during session, that there was energy from the governor's office of resistance to the bill. That part, I was disappointed to hear that during session.
So would you like to share with us what you were hearing?
Well, I mean, quite simply that he was trying to kill the bill. So my organization, you know, we do legislative advocacy. We've been doing it for a while. We founded it in 2010. And so one of the practices that we do is we meet with Speaker of the House, or that chief of staff, Senate president, or that chief of staff, and then with a Democratic governor, you know, with the administration. So we've met with the administration the past couple of summers to talk through some of our legislative items. Every summer that we've met with the administration, we've mentioned reparations. And we've mentioned reparations, not just the study portion of it, but we've actually presented a proposal as to what we think and some initial moves the state could make in regards to reparations. So, and during those conversations, the administration made it, you know, the stance they took was that they were generally supportive. It was just a question of the how. This past session, as I mentioned in a op-ed that I wrote for the Afro, you know, this past session, we presented something, a part of what we were told was that because of budget constraints, the budget shortfall, that it would be hard for the administration to support anything that would result in any money being paid out. And so we then decided that supporting a bill that would establish this study commission would be a good first step while the work being done to address the fiscal shortfall is being dealt with. The thinking being that, you know, there have been studies about issues of racial oppression. What there has not been, though, is a study by in the state of Maryland. It's a study that would develop how to operationalize a reparations policy. Like, what are the structures that would be needed? One of the things that we have said is, you know, cash payments should be on the table, but not the sum total or for us, even the focus of what reparations in Maryland would look like. But even if we're just talking about cash payments, the question is, well, what is the agency that holds it? What is the criteria for how it gets dispensed? You know, what is the mechanism that's going to hold those resources? What's the revenue stream? So there are all these important questions that if you're going to operationalize a reparations policy, it would be helpful to have a commission that's legislatively backed, whose job it is to be able to figure that out. So again, to your question, I mean, I was, again, surprised that they would be resistant to a mere study bill, right? Like that for me was like easy. I mean, I have said when I would, you know, do some radio, some, you know, public commentary on this back in January, part of what I would say is I think this is going to be an easy bill. Study bills tend to be easier than a bill that would actually distribute resources. So that part for me, I was surprised that a study bill of this nature would be something that would politically be this difficult.
And approximately how much money was required to impanel a reparations study commission?
So the commission was going to be about $54,000 that would go to the Maryland State Archives that would anchor the commission.
Wow. And so out of a huge budget, a Maryland budget, they couldn't find $54,000. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't mind me raising a sidebar, because you're in public policy, I'm a political scientist, so I'm always looking for patterns and practices. And as you are aware, one of the first acts by Governor Moore was to endorse House Bill 814 that lowered the age of incarceration to 10 years old. And I think, you know, behind closed doors and in polite company, no one ever thought that we were going to start incarcerating white 10-year-old boys. I mean, this was clearly a bill that was targeting Black children. And we realized, and the governor, in fact, signed this bill to lower the age of incarceration of Black boys, essentially, to about 10 years old. Are you beginning to see now a pattern in practice by this governor of what I would, well, why don't I ask you the question? Are you beginning to see a pattern of practice with the study bill being pushed to the side and a veto, with the incarceration, a bill that allows for 10-year-old children to be incarcerated? Are you beginning to see a pattern in practice with this governor?
So I will say a couple of things to that. The first, the Maryland Democratic Party, I think it's important to put in the context of the Maryland Democratic Party, because I think the work that we've done, that LBS has done over the years, we have seen that while there's a Democratic Party supermajority in Maryland, and while there's a way that they claim to be progressive on issues that most impact Black people, is where the party tends to be more conservative and actually agree with Republicans more than they would like people to believe. So if we take the example that you just gave around the rollbacks on some of the reforms to juvenile justice, there was an effort a few years ago to establish a Juvenile Justice Reform Council that would look at the ways that the juvenile justice system was inhumane to youth. And one of the things they found was that there were kids between the ages of 10, 11, 12, and 13 that were being incarcerated for things that it made more sense for them to have other pathways, like to not have them go into the system. So that was what the purpose of that was. One of the things that my organization has talked a lot about is Sinclair Media's presence in the political landscape. So there's up in the region I'm in, Fox 45, you know, which is a cable news network, and then local corporate news. And then you have the Baltimore Sun that was bought by the executive chairman, David Smith, of Sinclair Broadcasting. So they created in some ways a conservative echo chamber. And one aspect of that conservative echo chamber is the kind of dog whistling on notions of inherent Black criminality, particularly of Black youth, that's been happening over the past, you know, several years, that created an energy, that created a kind of zeitgeist amongst the legislature. And unfortunately, even folks in our own community, right, that would reach out to the legislators and say, oh, these kids are getting out of control, we got to lock them up. And so that resulted in 2024, the bill you're referencing, House Bill 814, that rolled back some of those reforms. So to me, that's an example of the Democrats essentially agreeing with Republicans in ways that they try to pretend to our community that they don't agree, right? That they try to present themselves as kind of allies to Black people. And so there's a whole conversation about how to deal with the duopoly and all of that. But to your question about, you know, the phrase you used in pattern and practice with Governor Moore, I think Governor Moore is being a Democrat. And I think one of the things that's important for our community to know is that that has limitations, especially a Democrat who may have political ambitions, right? Especially a Democrat whose history doesn't denote a connection to the Black radical tradition, right? Like there's nothing about Wes Moore that denotes a connection to the Black radical tradition. So in many ways, you know, what he is doing is what I would expect from any Democratic governor elected in the state of Maryland. My concern is that him being a Black man will be used as cover to not criticize him the way that we would criticize any other Democrat governor. So for me, it's important, again, HB 814, and then now Senate Bill 587, it's important for our community to learn the lesson that individual Black people in high levels of political office don't translate to improvement in quality of life of masses of Black people. That in fact, in many respects, typically that approach and that theory of change often leads to counter-revolutionary activity. It often leads to them being able to push back against more radical left and progressive policy. And so what we're seeing is, again, what I think we should expect to see from a Democratic governor, and we got to hold them accountable.
Yeah, so you're talking about this concept of Black gatekeeper, mm-hmm. So going back to the reparations study bill, because I think the issue of Black gatekeeping is going to continue to be a theme of this interview. Actually, mm-hmm. How can the reparations movement push back on the excuse that will be offered by most governments that reparations is just simply too expensive? It's just too expensive considering current financial deficits. So how can movements begin to push back on that kind of reactionary in many ways, but certainly conservative thoughts?
Yeah. So one of the places that, you know, I see myself as a person who has benefited greatly from the legacy and work of the reparations movement and borrow heavily from the reparations movement. The reparations movement emerging out of a revolutionary Black nationalist and Pan-African nationalist worldview. I think that's important because now, since reparations become more of a mainstream term, there are ways that people talk about reparations outside of its genealogy within the Black radical tradition. And so I mentioned that because one of the limitations sometimes of the reparations movement is on a policy level, being able to articulate like policy answers to that question of where the money will come from. So an example of what we would have been able to do in the proposal that we actually again gave that I referenced in the op-ed is that part of what we put forward was a series of tax policies that include additional tax brackets of people above $500,000 and then increasing the percentage, a capital gains tax. So those that, you know, make revenue off of, you know, capital, you know, stocks and bonds and capital, real estate, a surcharge on those capital gains. And then those resources going into, you know, a pot of resources that would be in perpetuity, right? So the idea being that, because I think sometimes the thought is we need, you know, a final figure to say, this is how much it costs. But I think as long as there's racism in America, right, this society owes Black people, right? And so those resources should be in perpetuity. I think another revenue stream that's been actually a part of our work, we actually have been able to establish the Community Repair and Reinvestment Fund from cannabis proceeds when recreational cannabis was legalized in the state of Maryland. One of the things we've said is regardless of if you're a person that consumes, it's coming to Maryland. So the question should be, those resources should be invested back in our community. So there actually is an existing Community Repair and Reinvestment Fund that has millions of dollars that are coming from recreational cannabis. So I think that could be the increase of the revenues from that could also go into this fund as well. So these are some of the answers to that question of when they say we can't afford it, or then here's some policies that we think if they move, would then finance whatever reparations policy that we would implement here in Maryland. I think those policies are viable. Those policies do, however, involve, in many respects, more leftist approach, policy approach to economic redistribution. So that's a place where, again, we'd have to push the Maryland Democratic Party that tends not to be progressive when it comes to economic redistribution.
Yeah, I've always found it interesting that a decision is made in terms of what's necessary and important depending upon the political perspective. When thinking, for example, war. You know, even though you might be in a deficit, a national deficit, which we're always in national deficit, but when it's time to engage militarily, somehow the money is created or found or minted. And in your recent article, which I would recommend to the WPFW audience, it's a brilliant article. So congratulations on your article on the Afro.
Thank you.
But in your recent article on the Afro, you write about the limits of mainstream Black political leadership when it's not rooted in militant transformative struggle. And so, you know, we have almost this cycle in the Black community of, you know, championing Black politicians without understanding, first of all, where their financial base is located in terms of who is actually financing the campaigns. And we're seeing that again in Montgomery County, where we've got Black politicians that are not rooted in the militant, in the historic traditions of radical politics, but are being seen, but are being displayed as Black leaders for the community to follow. And you talked a little bit about Obama and maybe a comparison to Moore. And I just wondered if you would elaborate in terms of how do Black people who have endured such racial oppression in this country begin to translate that or transform that thought into understanding the economic basis and the linkages between these politicians and what they're hoping to see at some point in terms of public policy outcomes. So a lot of people felt when Obama was elected, for example, that that was going to translate into better conditions for Black people. And I think the same is true for Wes Moore. How do we begin to break that cycle, considering our history?
Yeah, I think a part of it is that there is a dominant mainstream historiography that is made most available to us that then influences our theories of change. I think the average person, the average Black person, because of the narratives of history that they've been taught, individual Black figures being able to petition white folks to recognize our humanity, that's the dominant historiography. It's not truth in terms of what has actually advanced our community, but it is the historiography that many of us are socialized into. So it leads to a situation where many people in our community then cling to that theory of change. They see particularly an intelligent, smart Black person ascend to political leadership. And unfortunately, many people in our community, that's the theory of change that makes the most sense to them. And in some contexts, they've experienced some minor benefits when there is an individual person in office. You know, there's some people who've experienced some of the individual benefits of that. And so a part of it is in terms of the political education needed in our community to discern how we are to relate to those in elected office. People who run for office, most of the time, are not products of our community. They are curated from a white corporate political elite mainstream. And the people that run for office, they know which fundraisers to go to, which cocktail parties, which fellowships, which organizations. And so by the time we are voting for many of the people in elected office, they've already been curated for us. We're picking different flavors of the same kind of curated list of political figures. So part of it is us getting to a place where we can build the independent Black electoral infrastructure to be able to produce our own people in elected office. In the meantime, though, it's important for us to recognize that, you know, America is, in terms of the structure of the political economy, is a plantation, right? And there's a quote, again, I use it all the time, this Hubert Henry Harrison quote around, you know, chattel slavery was enforced before the Civil War by brute force, wage slavery enforced after the Civil War, enforced by starvation, right? So those in the kind of donor class, the white dominated donor class, are able to starve people into compliance, right, to the system. So many of the people that are in elected office, they are folks for whom, to varying degrees, are on that plantation, right? They are sharecroppers of white political and economic power, right? And one of the things that I've often said to people is, because the way that politics is told to us is through a lens of personality. You tell me three things about an elected person, I know everything I need to know. You tell me what their training and socialization is. You tell me who stands to benefit from them being in office. And you tell me where their money comes from. You tell me those three things, I know everything I need to know politically about that person in elected office. And so I think the way that as a community, we have to see ourselves as being engaged in political warfare. Right. The arena of politics is contestation for resources and power. And as Black people, we need to be organized in a way where we are able to operationalize our interests and deal political blows against those who are in office that don't conform to what our community needs. And I think, unfortunately, because of the theory of change that I started out describing, people don't recognize America's a settler colony. It is not a democracy. To the extent that Black people are going to experience freedom, it'll be from sovereign, political, militant activity. But again, I think a lot of people are attached to this American dream, right? And so I think what it does, it is seductive then to think, man, if we can just get this good individual person in office, they'll look out for us. And I think history shows us that is not an effective way for us to really have liberation for the masses of our people. So that's what I would say, is that I think it's important for the community to recognize that. And even though the theory of change that I'm describing is something that takes some historical knowledge to disabuse oneself of, I think those of us that do have that understanding, it's important to point it out and to be able to criticize, in this case, you know, Governor Moore, to be able to criticize him in a way that people can see. And that was part of what I was trying to do in the op-ed, is to kind of like showing people, like, this is how this works. This isn't a personal thing. It's not about liking them, disliking them. I want them to be as successful as a human being. But I'm clear that theory of change that is dependent on capitulating to the corporate white, you know, monopoly capital, mainstream political environment, that is a dead end in terms of Black liberation. It's important for our community to know that.
Last question. Yeah, I was fascinated by your article. I thought it was, like I said before, I thought it was really brilliant. And so I'm really sort of pushing it this morning for everyone to read the Afro article, because I think you'll find it concise, analytical, smart, strategic. Everyone should look at this article. So could you briefly discuss the historical narratives? And I think you've started that it provides concrete material change for Black people that do not necessarily appeal to white people. And one of the things that you say in your article is, no matter how decent, bright, or accomplished a major Black political figure is, if that person is operating from a theory of change that relies on garnering white mainstream support, policy proposals like reparations will never be viable, hence the veto by the governor. Could you elaborate on that just for the few minutes we have left?
Yeah, so I think as I started about the historiography, you know, one of the things that is deeply injected into our consciousness. And I think many people don't even know they believe this, which is, in order to have a successful fight in the political landscape, there has to be some good white person somewhere. And we got to figure out how to get white people on board if reparations is going to happen. And I think that that is a belief that I think has become politically debilitating, right? Because what ends up happening is that then our community doesn't think it's possible. And unfortunately, it's reinforced by a lot of what we see in terms of corporate news, right? It's the stories that are most highly visible or stories where people are appealing to white folks as the basis for change that happens for our community. I mentioned earlier the Community Repair and Reinvestment Fund that what for us was an effort of reparations for the war on drugs. And we're successfully able to get a 35% of those proceeds to come back to the communities impacted by the war on drugs. So we're currently in the phase of implementation around the state and different counties in terms of spending those monies, you know, in the community. And a story that I like to tell is because one of the committees that we had to get it through was the Finance Committee in the Senate. And it's an 11-member committee. Four of members of the committee, you need six votes to pass anything through the committee. Four of those members were Black. One from Baltimore City, two from Prince George's County, one from Baltimore County. And in the initial bill that was drafted on that, what they did was they had essentially a structure of giving out money to community-based organizations that it would have been like a nonprofit in state government and would have essentially given money to some of the same kind of corporate, nonprofit, white-led organizations that typically get resources. So we came in, we worked with then-Senator Jill Carter, in her draft of the bill, had the language for the Community Repair and Reinvestment Fund, went to Senator Hayes, who's on that committee, who went to the other three state reps on that committee and essentially made a condition, like their votes was conditioned on that language being put in the bill, right? And that is how that language got in the bill, right? So we were able to create a mechanism by which more Black folks would be able to have access to control the distribution of those resources. I tell that story because the fight for us wasn't how do we get these white people to be on board, right, with this fund structure. What it was we used the fact that we have enough power on that committee to force them to do it.
Right.
And I think very, very few Black people have ever had the experience of wielding power that did not emanate from being sanctioned by white mainstream society. Right. So that's a part of, in terms of the perspective that I'm offering, is that if we have more time, that is the way that Black people have been able to advance our position, is the kind of militant, sovereign, political, in some instances, military confrontation with this political status quo. That has been, to the extent that Black people have made progress, how progress has been made. And so that then would help us, if that was broadly understood, that would then help us refute the existing theory of change, which is Black faces in high places translate to benefits for our community. We know that not to be true, but again, it requires a different historiography in order to make that clear and to show the implementation of it such that our people aren't walking around with the deeply held belief, how do we get white people on board? We're going to make them do it, and we're going to build the political might to make them do it.
Davon Love, this is an incredible interview. Will you promise to come back on the show?
Yeah, anytime.
I feel like we're just beginning to scratch the surface and our time is up. So we will have you back. And I'm particularly interested in understanding, you know, how we begin to use and understand your theory in terms of how we begin to navigate this Black administration and begin to use Black power to, in fact, impact a Black administration now. Because we're in new territory here, historically. And so thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show this morning.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. We will take a quick break for community announcements.
Thank you, family. We're so grateful for each and every one of you who made a pledge during our spring membership drive. Though we didn't quite reach the finish line, your love carried us far. Your pledges, your presence, your belief in WPFW. They remind us that this station is more than radio. It's a rhythm, a refuge, a revolution. We trust you'll keep walking with us, dancing with us, building with us, because this community-powered radio station rises with you and only with you. Thank you for keeping the beat alive.
Of course, that group session, Pan-Africanism 101.
Okay, just and give me that hand signal. Well, welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marcia Adebayo. Our next guests are Mr. Paul Pumphrey of the Friends of the Congo, and Baba Mosi Meshatela, president of the UNIA, Woodson Banneker, Jackson Bay Division, number 330. And we will discuss the current situation in the West African country of Burkina Faso. Paul and Baba Mosi, welcome to WPFW.
Thank you very much.
President Ibrahim Traoré, the president of Burkina Faso, is 37 years old. He was educated at the University of Ouagadougou. President Traoré is a Burkinabe military officer and politician who has served as the president of, or the interim president of Burkina Faso since 2022. President Traoré has sought to reestablish indigenous industry in the country while severing colonial ties such as France and the U.S. that have exploited his people. He's played an instrumental role in the founding of the Alliance of Sahel States. While Africans around the world have applauded President Traoré, these policies have angered leaders such as President Donald Trump. Paul, can you compare and contrast the vision of the late Pan-Africanist and president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, with President Traoré?
Thank you, Marcia. First, I wanted to say that Kwame Nkrumah, from the very beginning, had a dream of a united Africa, not broken up by the way the colonial powers had broken up Africa into several different colonies, but a united Africa that worked collectively together to address the needs of the African people in Africa. President Traoré has done something very similar to that, and working with developing an alliance with two of his neighboring countries, that of Mali and that of Niger. And that alliance seems to be steady growing every day. In fact, recently, Chad has expressed a real interest in joining the Alliance of Sahel States. Now, having an alliance in West Africa is nothing new, because you had ECOWAS, which was an organization of 14 different countries that supposedly came together to develop the economy of West Africa, in which at one time, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger were members of ECOWAS. But it became very clear to them that the heads of those states became clear to them that ECOWAS was serving the interests not of West Africa, but serving the interests of the former colonial powers that had been exploiting Africa for the last 200 years. And so they made a decision, in fact, to remove their country's membership to ECOWA and create a whole new entity, which is called the Alliance of the States, the Alliance of the, was an ECOWA.
The Shell, Sahel.
The Alliance of the Sahel. And why is that? It's because they recognize that they wanted to serve the interests of the people in their country and in their region and not be used to be exploited to benefit the economy of Europe, Canada, the United States, and other parts of the world. What does this mean? Well, one, they had US troops, French troops in their country, supposedly fighting terrorists. They were getting guns. The terrorists themselves were getting the guns from the United States and from Europe. So the question was, were these troops sincere in trying to develop a security for these countries, or were they just there to keep these countries in a dependent state? And it became clear that they were there to keep those countries independent state. In fact, the United States had a drone base in Niger. And this drone base, Niger was not even privy to understand or be given the information that was gathered by these drones in their country. And so the United States pick and chose what to share as far as information was concerned. So one of the first things that President Ture did when he came to power was to negotiate with the country of Turkey, who makes very sophisticated drones, to in fact buy, I believe there were 27 drones that they bought from Turkey, so that they would have control over their own drones and the information that was gathered by their own drones. And one of the provisions they had for Turkey was that Turkey had to train the pilots of those drones in Burkina Faso, that you didn't have foreigners who had control over that information, but you had the locals whose interests would be served by those drones, controlling the information that was gathered by those drones. And the result of that was they were able to really cut down on the invasion of terrorist groups coming across the border, especially at night, to intimidate and disrupt the economy and the security of the outlying communities to their country. This was noticed by the people of the country that things became a little bit safer. Another thing he decided to do was Burkina Faso, I believe, is the fourth largest gold reserve in Africa. And so he decided to cancel the foreign contracts of mining companies that had been taking a very large percentage of the value of the gold out of the country. Now, one thing a lot of people may not know about gold is that when you mine it out of the ground, it comes in a format of gold dust. And if you did a simple process of just heating up that gold to about 2,000 degrees, you could melt that gold into a gold brick. Well, that simple process literally increased the value of the gold by seven times. And by them selling their gold as gold dust, they were being robbed because France and other countries that were buying the gold would take in the gold dust to their country and make it into gold bricks. And automatically, just by heating it up, they got seven times the value that they paid for the gold for. And so by him outlawing the export of that gold, that gold dust out of the country and building a refinery in the country where they were now making the gold into bricks in the country, he increased the resources in the country by seven times. Another thing was that he took those resources and he produced several different programs. But I will yield to Brother Babamosi, who could go into much more detail about those programs.
Before I release you, Brother Paul, though, let me ask you one more question. And that is that President Traore has become an icon.
Yes.
For African youth around the world, including the United States, Canada, Europe. He has become sort of the almost a rock star in terms of a head of state in Africa, who see his administration as a window of hope for the African continent. Why have African youth in particular become so fascinated with President Traore and the vision of One Africa?
Well, the most important part is that they see that the programs that he's doing versus many of the other heads of states in Africa is actually improving the economy, it's improving the healthcare, it's improving the educational institutions inside of Burkina Faso, and they would like to see that same type of thing happen in their own country. And so by him setting the examples that the old myth that Africa just needs Europe and the United States and the NATO nations to move forward, he has shot a huge hole in that statement and shown the world, as well as African people, as far away as Kenya, which is in East Africa, Southern East Africa, that in fact, they do not have to follow the road that their governments have been taking their countries down. And that in fact, that they can improve the economy of their countries, they can improve the healthcare of their country, they can improve the education of their country, and they can improve the development of their country if their government changed the way they do business with other countries, in particular the NATO countries around the world.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much. Babamosi, alternatively, President Trump and Western nations are alarmed and concerned that President Traore is redefining African politics and Africa's relationship to the West. Can you help our listeners understand this perspective?
Well, no one should be surprised at the Western countries being alarmed at what is happening. You know, this situation is very similar to what has happened before. Let's say you mentioned Kwame Nkrumah and what happened in Ghana. You know, it's the same mindset, the same thought process. It's developing your country, developing your nation, and getting together with other nations in Africa or other countries in Africa, coming together to be as one, to confront the colonial powers in what they were doing, exploiting these people for hundreds of years. So what they're seeing now, as in Burkina Faso, for instance, he's doing something that's alarming, especially France. That gold and whatever other minerals that's coming out of that place, France can't do without. And so it's very alarming to them that if this person is going to, as Paul mentioned earlier, if he's going to add to the value of that product, which was going out to France in a primary state, if you're going to add to the value internally right there in Burkina Faso, it means France will be losing money. It means France will be losing income. So what it is that they can't stand that. None of the Europeans can stand it. And seeing it happening to France, in their minds, they're also thinking about the other countries. For instance, the ex-British colonial countries that are still sort of connected to that metropole in economics, they're confronted with a problem in the future. Another thing too, when we coming to the point of Nkrumah, is that Nkrumah did not try to do this only with the Western countries, just developing his countries and getting the people to be, you know, self-reliant, following that pathway that comes out of Marcus Garvey, because, you know, he had that process, mind process, Marcus Garvey, and mixed with a little bit of socialism and all that. And so this is mind-bending for the Europeans. And they wanted to get rid of him, and they did get rid of Nkrumah. Fast forward to today, this is no change in their mind in the way they do things. It's the same playbook, you know.
Yeah.
They've tried that already several times in Burkina Faso, what they did to Nkrumah and Ghana, and that is getting the officers in the military, you know, to do a coup and get rid of Kwame Nkrumah. And so with Kwame Nkrumah, of course, came into power through elections, but he came into power with a lot of the support of the people, more support from the people than, let's say, the military. The military was, you know, trained by the British. Their own mindset, and I can tell you about those people, their mindset is British. Their training was British, and they don't see it any other way. Now, what Kwame Nkrumah did was he appealed to the socialist states, China and Russia and others, so that, you know, he would not be kicking against the goad when he's trying to do things for his country. That alarmed, of course, the metropoles. And so they had to get rid of him, as I said before. Now, This is what's coming up here with Burkina Faso. And we have to be very careful. We have to stay with Traore in a sense of supporting him. And that is why the young people, the worldwide, they understand this. That is why they in the 31st of April, the entire world of African young youth came together in solidarity with Traore and saying, no, he has to stay. And they won't tolerate him being overthrown. It's left to be seen, but let's face it, France and these other guys, you know, they don't stop at anything. They'll continue to try to overthrow Traore. But he's doing a fine job, you know, was mentioned earlier. And so we have to understand that if we don't do the same thing, those of us here in the United States, and of course the United States, we had the solidarity calls all around, and in many cities, young people and other people came out to show their solidarity with Traore. So in essence, we have to watch that, and hopefully he will defeat anything that comes against him in trying to overthrow him.
Yeah, it's important that you alert our listeners to the fact that President Traore has been the target of numerous assassination attempts.
Yes.
And he is still holding strong, and his country is still behind him. I just wanted the two of you for maybe 2 minutes to talk about the Alliance of Sahel States. Because this is very exciting, because this is really the dream of Kwame Nkrumah and the early African independence leaders. And that is the confederation and the dropping of the borders between Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. And the concept of one Africa. And one Africa extends beyond the continent of Africa, by the way, to the children of Africa as well. So can you just, between the two of you, talk a little bit about this concept of one Africa and what a difference it will make? And also we have to at least say the name Muammar Gaddafi when we're talking about the concept of one Africa. Because after all, one of the reasons why his life was taken was because he was promoting the issue of one Africa. So can you both talk a little bit, just a minute or so, about the concept of one Africa and the difference it would make in the lives of the people on the continent if they weren't divided by all these artificial colonial boundaries. Right. Paul, you want to start?
Paul is,
1 minute.
Paul is handing it over.
I'm handing it over to Bob and Lucy. Go ahead.
Well, let me say this. One Africa means just that. One Africa. It means borderless countries. It means doing for self, self-determination by the people of Africa. And we have to confront Europe and other enemies because they don't want Africa to be the countries in Africa to be together, because working together means Europe can't defeat them. Europe can't exploit them. And it's understood quite well by a lot of the young people, because they're reading a lot of this stuff, and maybe they, you know, they're reading by themselves. Maybe they're not being educated in their schools, but that school of thought is coming from somewhere, as it did for Traoré and others. I mean, you know, he had examples before him. And Kwame Nkrumah is one of those who, as Paul mentioned earlier, he was talking about one Africa. This is, you know, his country cannot be free unless all other countries in Africa was free as well. He had seen that. Now, one Africa means your currency. You know, you've got 54 countries or 55, all with different currencies, and they can't use it for trade among themselves. Nonsense. What is needed is a currency which they can use to trade among themselves, and so they don't have to get money from a CFA franc or this other thing to go to different countries. And the US dollar, for instance, that's dominating the world in trade. They just imagine Africa with its own currency. What's the US dollar can do to that? It's unimaginable how big and how powerful that could be. And this is why the French especially are watching at how Burkina Faso is aligning itself with other countries outside of the European world, the European or the Western world, and developing itself because it's determining what they want for self.
And so
we can't expect anything different but one Africa being a powerful construct against white supremacy.
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention too is that in Burkina Faso now they're actually manufacturing their own cars.
Yeah,
it's amazing. So even in terms of transportation now, this small country, you know, the cars are not coming out of Nigeria or South Africa. They're coming out of Burkina Faso. And they're manufacturing their own car. It's an amazing experiment. We're running out of time. So Paul, do you have a minute that you want to add to that? Because we only have 1 minute.
Yeah, one thing I'll say is this, is that it's very, very important. And when you look at Europe, you have the euro dollar. So this concept of having one Africa is not new. You have the European Union. In the United States, you've got 50 states, but it's one
United States of America.
In the United States of America. So Africa is not asking for something new. It's asking for something that has been tried by other parts of the world, which has benefited those parts of the world. And Africa says it only should benefit them as well, is that they work as a united front and not allow outside forces divide them and working against themselves. And so that's just a simple concept.
I agree. It's a fascinating experiment, and it's so exciting to be alive during this period of history where we're seeing and not only the alliance of the Sahel, but also in Namibia, for example. I mean, so African nations are beginning to, you know, advance in ways that are very exciting. I just wanted to take the last minute of this show. I want to talk a little bit about the Bethesda BACC Juneteenth celebration on June 19th. And Baba Mosey and Paul, we only have 2 minutes left, but can you tell us a little bit about the BACC Juneteenth celebration?
Yes, it's an occasion that And I'm saying this so that not to exclude others, but where all Black folks need to get to. You know, Juneteenth celebrates an event that occurred in the history of the United States, and that is Texas. I won't go into that. But what we're having there at the VACC Juneteenth commemoration is something that everybody will enjoy and will come out being exposed to things that should open their minds to what is happening, and especially we're talking about the cemetery. Now, who are we going to have? We're going to have some people there who people would love to hear and enjoy. And I'll start with the keynote speaker, for instance. The keynote speaker will be Washington, D.C.'s own civil rights lawyer, celebrated civil rights lawyer, Nkechi Taifa. And Nkechi Taifa, you know, she's also an author. She's a poet. You know, she's a public speaker. And she's there dealing with reparations. And I think she will focus on reparations on that day. And for fun, you know, folks, we're going to have Ben and Jerry's. We're going to have some free ice cream, you know, a little bit of that taste of free ice cream. Ben and Jerry's one of the best ice cream around, if not the best. And that's a treat for anyone who comes out there and come together with us. We will have speakers from the UNIA, ACL, Rehabilitating Committee. We will have a libation. Okay. Storytellers, everyone. We will have African People's Socialist Party, Green Party, you know, Jimmy, Claudia Jones School, Friends of the Congo. Yes, of course, but Paul is going to be there, so you know if Friends of the Congo will be there.
So, okay, yeah. We have 20 seconds. Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you so much, Baba Mosey. The VACC Juneteenth will be at 5204 River Road from 2:30 to 5 p.m. So I'd like to thank both of you for being on the show today. It's been a very exciting, intellectually stimulating day. Guest today, Davon Love, Paul Pumphrey, Baba Mosey. Thanks to executive producer Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Michael Nasella. I'm Marcia Adebayo. We are celebrating the 22nd year of the signing of the No Fear Act, the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. WPFW supports whistleblowers.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Peace! This is your social justice calendar for the week of May 26, 2025. On Thursday, May 29th, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video Books and Cafe presents Journalism in Ethiopia with Jamal Countess at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, go to sankofa.com. On Saturday, May 31st, from 3 to 6:30 p.m., EDT Save the Block Chinatown Park recognizes this AANHPI month by fighting to protect Chinatown small businesses, an afternoon of education, celebration, art, and action in Chinatown. For more info, visit diversecityfund.org. On Sunday, June 1st, at 7 p.m., Haile Jerima and Sankofa Video and Books present Haiti on Our Mind, a bi-weekly community gathering, the impact of Haiti and Haitians in the United States, discussion with Eugenia Charles and Jordan Strudwick. For more info, please visit sankofa.com. WPFW's social justice calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m. at least 1 week in advance of your event. Thank you to all of the listener sponsors who donated during our Spring Pledge Drive to keep our independent community station, WPFW-FM, operating. WPFW Social Justice Calendar builds a better world, one broadcast at a time.
How to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered.